Welcome everyone to the latest episode of the Bible Feed podcast. I'm Josh Dean, and today I have Dan Weatherall here with me. How are you doing, Dan?
Good, thanks. Josh, how are you?
Very well. Spring is here in the UK where we are recording, and so not particularly because of the time of year, we've decided to change things up a little bit. If you're a frequent listener to the podcast, you know that we often do a lot of sort of high-level book introductions where we look at an overview of a book at the whole thing, where it starts, the beginning, the middle, and the end. But this week, we are going to try and analyze a smaller section of a letter, one particular passage, a famous passage in the letter to the Philippians and chapter 2. It's a section about Jesus being in the form of God, and Dan is going to help us try to work out what that means. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we'll give it a try. It's good, isn't it, to sometimes drill down into the detail. The high-level stuff is great. I think it's essential, really important to do, to keep that in mind. But then sometimes we really need to get down into the different interpretations, look at pros and cons of a very specific passage. So that's what we're going to be doing, maybe looking at various translations as well. So also this might be a good exercise in how to use different translations, making sure you're comparing with other different translations, some old, some modern, and just see if you think that they're capturing the essence of the passage.
Yes, this section in Philippians chapter 2 is, I suppose, a debated section with a number of different viewpoints on it. And so we're going to try and consider those and weigh them and balance them together here. So why don't I read through the section at hand first? Now, for those of you keeping score at home, I'm reading from the ESV here. And the section we're looking at is in the letter to the Philippians chapter 2. And I'll begin at verse 5 and read through to verse 11. So this is Philippians 2 and starting at verse 5. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So there it is. There's our passage. Do you understand that immediately? Does it sort of unravel itself and present itself in a very clear way to you? That's the question, I suppose.
Is there a plain meaning that we can just read it, understand it intrinsically and intuitively? I mean, you get the sense of what it's about, I think. This is an amazing and profound example of humility, isn't it? So we'll come on to that. But you don't have to turn far to any commentator, and they'll tell you this is a very contentious passage, as in okay. There's so many different ways that people have understood it. For example, the pretty well-respected Word Biblical Commentary says in this section, this is the most important section in the letter and surely the most difficult to interpret. It says that all the different sort of problems and mass of books and articles, it says, it leaves one wondering where to begin, despairing about adding anything new and well-nigh stricken with mental paralysis. So it's our job, Josh, if we can do this, to cut through that mental paralysis. I don't know if we'll manage to do it, but we'll give it a shot. And it's important to notice, isn't it, I think, that there are passages in the Bible that are difficult. You know, we do a lot of high-level stuff, and that's good, and you can get sort of a clear overarching sense of the design and the purpose of passages in that way. But then sometimes there's some really difficult passages. You've got to try and work out what on earth it means. This is, again, perhaps an example episode of that very phenomenon happening. And we've got to sort of demonstrate a bit of time and care to just think through all the different things. Some parts of the Bible are clear and pretty obvious. This isn't one of those parts.
It also, I suppose, adding to the mental paralysis, this seems like quite an important section. It's dealing with big concept. It's not a throwaway comment. One, it's quite a long, extended section, clearly dealing with this same subject. And yes, as that quotation says, it's possibly the most important section of the letter. So we've got to try and get our heads around it. Let's set the table then. Let's ask some context questions that might help us sort of orient ourselves and begin to start taking some steps. Who's writing? Who's speaking here? And who's reading this letter?
Yeah, okay. So it's Paul, the apostle. So he wrote many of the letters, didn't he, in the New Testament. So he's writing to to Christians, to people who have already chosen to follow Christ, and they've heard the good news, they've heard the gospel, and they've become Christians, they've become followers of Christ, and they're in Philippi, so that's North Greece, isn't it? It's Macedonia, ancient Macedonia, which I think is within Greece today.
That's right. I've been, and our Airbnb host will get Philippi, which I thought was interesting. Oh, but yes, I've always known it as Philippi myself, but there you go.
Yeah, okay, Philippi, maybe from now on. we'll see what we do. I'm sure there's many different pronunciations around the world from our global listener base.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so, there's a lot in this letter. I mean, essentially, he's writing to them to say thank you very much for a gift that they've given him. So you get that sort of later on in the letter. Mm-hmm. But he's also taking the opportunity to encourage them in various things, but and also making sure they really understand that they need to act with a certain amount of humility. So for example, we started at verse 5, didn't we, I think? Yeah. But the chapter starts, we could read the whole thing for context, and I'd encourage you to do that. That'd be a good thing to do. But let's just dive into the start of chapter 2. So we read, if there's any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being of full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, and so on. So it absolutely carries on, doesn't it? So this is a very practical section, actually. Too often it becomes just a theological debate, like lots of parts of the Bible. But actually, they're always, nearly always, set in a sort of practical guidance on behaviour. So whatever interpretation we come up with, we've got to try and see it in that context, I think.
That's interesting, is it? Because yes, the section I read out, if you just had that, you wouldn't perhaps think, well, this is clearly a practical section with a sort of a list of to-dos, as it were, or things to do or things to avoid. But that section at the beginning, you're absolutely right. Avoid selfish ambition. Think about the interests of others, not just your own interests. This idea of same-mindedness and some sort of congeniality and trying to work together is clearly stuff that you could put into practice. And then we have this section as an example to help you and encourage you in that. Paul, in his letter, is aiming at something and is trying to get something to happen. And so this is how he's going to do it. So we've got to work that in somehow. Okay, right. Let's begin then. You said there are lots of different ways to interpret this, but what's one common one that we can start with?
So probably the broadest way of understanding this would be very common, and this is the assumption, I think, that most people approach this text, most Christians will approach this text, thinking that this is talking about Jesus's divinity. So when it says Jesus was in the form of God, they'll take that as, he actually is God. His essence, he has the essence of God. The essence is divine. So there will be lots of different permutations as to how you understand that, but that's basically one broad sort of umbrella option.
Okay.
So if you have a look at some different translations, you'll see that comes through quite clearly, actually. So pretty famously in the NIV, New International Version, we read, they translate these couple of verses, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. So it says there, Jesus is in very nature God. And he didn't use that to his advantage, and then he went and proceeded to do something humble. So does that come through that translation?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
And you see it a little bit, actually, in the King James Version as well. So not in the phrase, in the form of God, which was quite an ambiguous phrase, really, isn't it, in the English?
Like, yeah, in all the sorts form of things. Gives you a bit of a range of things you can take that. Yeah.
So the King James has that pretty, famously, that sort of ambiguous phrase says, Jesus, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took him up upon him the form of a servant. So, and the point there is he didn't think it was robbery to be equal with God, i.e. he was equal with God, and he didn't think that it was a bad thing for him to be equal, if you see what I mean. He already has it. He has the equality. And that matches the NIV saying he didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. So these two translations, the NIV especially, will say that he's very nature God, but also they'll make an assumption that the equality with God is something that Jesus already has, and that he then chooses to not use that in a particular way, and that becomes the mark of humility. And so what this becomes, if that's right, if these translations are right, and Jesus is indeed God in very nature, then what this passage becomes is about Jesus existing before his birth, choosing to become a human, which is, you know, the incarnation, isn't it? That's what it's referred to, that the theological idea that Jesus had some pre-existence as God, and however you understand incarnation, because there's lots of different ways of people understanding it, but he chose in humility to become human. And there's so now we're in the ESV again, so I'm just going to quote back to you, it's for end of verse 7.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a phrase there in the ESV that seems to support this. So at the end of verse 7, it says, actually, let's just read it all. He emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So there we go. It seems pretty clear, if you take that, the English translation there, that this is talking about him choosing to be human and being born in the likeness of men. So that kind of supports that idea.
Right. So in that first interpretation, Jesus already has a form, a nature, an essence of divinity, and doesn't choose to use that advantageously, and instead does something humble. So it sort of starts high and chooses to, to sort of condescend and become born on a human level. One thing I noticed as we were reading through the NIV version, that first version that you read, it says, Jesus, who being in the very nature God, and then later on says he made himself nothing by taking on the very nature of a servant. So what would that mean, to take on the very nature of a servant, and sort of to balance that out as to, you know, the very nature of a God in some sense?
Yeah, and I think that shows a difficulty with translating it like this, doesn't it? Because one thing that is really clear is that when you read verses 6 and 7 together, that Jesus was in the form of God, but verse 7, he took the form of a servant. So absolutely clear, and it's the same Greek word, morphe, in this. So it's very clearly like designed to be a contrast there. So if you understand the phrase, the form of God, as like being and essence and nature, in the very nature God, well, and then you're left with a conundrum, aren't you? Like you say, what does being in the form of a servant, being very nature servant, mean? So I think that should give a little sort of red flag and say, hold on a minute, have we got this right?
Okay.
It does being in the form of God mean essence and nature? So that would be one problem with it. Another one as well, it's a curious expression, I think, if Jesus was indeed very nature God, it then talks about equality with God. And if you are God, you're not equal with yourself, are you? It's another curious way of phrasing it, if that's the case. I just think, again, this is a little red flag just for you to sort of, when you're going through this systematically and thinking, does it mean this? Is it teaching that Jesus is God? He chose to have human nature and not use his equality. Well, if he is God, how can he be equal with himself? So that seems to suggest that Jesus, you know, is different from God. Whether or not he has equality, that's something we'll think about in a little bit. But he's different.
Yeah, to imply that, yeah, to be viewed as having equality with something else requires, I think, some sort of distinction between the two. And yes, another red flag that we might have with this interpretation.
So the other thing is just to be precise about who we're talking about. So that's in verse 5. And again, it's very easy just to pass over this. So have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. So we're talking about Jesus here, Jesus Christ, Christ being the word for Messiah. Jesus was the name given to the child born to Mary. So it's not the name of anything that pre-existed him and became the baby that was born, if you see what I mean. Jesus and indeed Christ, they're the name and the title given to Jesus, the man, not the pre-existing divine person of the Trinity or whatever it is. So this perhaps suggests that we're not talking about anything before the birth of Jesus Christ. We're actually talking about the man, Jesus Christ, who, whatever it means, was in the form of God and chose to be humble in this way. Looking at this with precision, I think, will help us.
Yeah, we have to start the clock running at some point around the year zero in the region of the Galilee, and it begins there, because that's when the name Jesus was given to the person that we know today as Jesus, who is also then referred to as Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the anointed. Right, so we're not looking all the way back to the foundation of creation or pre-creation sort of times, but instead to that grounded moment in history.
Mm. And I think what it does, it sets up a bit of a contradiction between the way that the ESV has translated that end of verse 7, being born in the likeness of men. And so perhaps what I've just suggested is an incorrect way, and that there might be a way of understanding that differently, that we are talking about him before he was born. Or perhaps we need to look at whether being born in the likeness of men is a decent translation, which we'll hopefully get to as we sort of systematically go through this. So that's important, just throws up these questions, I think. And then the other thing is that this word form, so this, we're really getting into the central heart of this, the form of God, or the form of a servant, morphe, which is the Greek word. And it's not a common word at all in the New Testament, but it always means outward appearance. So I think the only other place, actually, let's just have a look at this, in Mark chapter 16. So it's in, it's in the long ending of Mark, actually. Mark 16, verse 12. After these things, he, that's Jesus, appeared in another form to two of them as they were walking into the country. So it's talking about a post-resurrection appearance, and he appeared in another form. And that's like a classic way of this word is used. It's talking about outward appearance, you know, from the perspective of the onlookers. And if you go to any kind of lexicon, you'll get that. The theological lexicon of the New Testament says it's stature, form, condition, feature, external appearance, reproduction. So, you know, it's emphasis on the external feature.
So the outward appearance, something that a passerby, those who are glancing at the person or the object, would be able to ascertain, rather than some hidden or intrinsic or inherent internal essence being kind of description, but rather something that you could judge by looking at something. Okay.
Right. That's right. And so one commentator about this, Andrew Perriman, a scholar who's written about this in a book called In the Form of a God, and we'll come to that in a bit towards the end, he says it's unlikely that Paul would have intended morphe theou, in the form of a God, or in the form of God, as a reference to the being or some essential attribute of God. The thought is consistently of the outward appearance of an object of being, not of some inner quality. So he's done a big review of that word and its use sort of outside the Bible and so on. Do you think this interpretation fits the context, or what do you reckon?
Well, so we said that Paul here is trying to encourage, inspire, or prompt some practical response from the Philippians to be of one mind, to esteem each other better than themselves, think about the interests of others. And so there's got to be some practical engagement, I suppose, from them, energized by the example that they've been given here. So they've got to show this example of humility. And so it's difficult to follow in the footsteps of a pre-existing God, choosing to take on human nature and being born as a man, as a practical thing to do. So yes, it doesn't sit easily, I think, in that sort of context. With that in mind and what we've said, what other options are there when it comes to different ways to interpret this section?
Okay, we'll put that one to one side and sort of look at a couple of other ideas and then sort of see where we get to, see what's more likely when we get to the end of this. So another way that people have come at this passage is to take that phrase in the form of God as make it sort of synonymous with being in the image of God. So being in the image of God coming directly from Genesis 1, of course, the creation account, where we read God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And what that does, it not only looks to Genesis 1, but also then looks to Genesis 2, where we have the story of Adam and the man, Adam and the woman, Eve, in the Garden of Eden. So it's in the Eden narrative there. And there's some really interesting parallels, actually, between Philippians 2 and Genesis 2 and 3. So, for example, in chapter 3, the serpent comes to speak to the woman and says, if you eat of the fruit, you will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. So it's really quite possibly a parallel there, isn't there, with this idea, wanting to grasp at equality with God, you will be like God. And so the woman there takes that opportunity, she grasps at it, and takes the opportunity to be like God. It's not what she should have done. It was a temptation for her. Whereas in Philippians 2, Jesus, he resists and he's humble and different.
Yes, you've really got a parallel, a bit of a resonance there with Jesus not doing what Eve and Adam did do back in Genesis 3. And so perhaps Paul is setting that up to trigger the readers to go back and think and do a comparison between those two.
There's perhaps contrast between the people, humanity, generally what humans do. We grasp at these opportunities to try and take advantage and give ourselves an advantage. And actually, remember the context, it's about Paul saying, do nothing from rivalry or conceit or vain ambition as well. So, don't do these things for this with this ambition. And yet, and here's an example of someone who didn't act ambitiously like every human generally does.
Okay. So this interpretation, Jesus exercises the self-control, the consideration for others that Paul is trying to exhort the Philippians to, and doesn't grasp, doesn't reach up or try to attain to something he has an ability to, but chooses not to. Okay. So what are some problems perhaps that we might run into if we carry this on, this interpretation number two?
It's difficult, I think, to look at this phrase in the form of God and think it should be synonymous with in the image of God. So in all humanity are made in the image of God. You get that in lots of different passages.
Of course.
And and yet this feels like there's something unique about Jesus here, that, in he being in the form of God, and yet he didn't act like this. So, it doesn't seem to be a phrase that is suggesting, oh, he was just a human in that sense. That phrase isn't a phrase to say he was part of humanity. So we've got to try and work out what it means by that. And again, I think there's similar problems with comparing the next verse where it talks about being in the form of a servant. So if being in the form of God means the image of God, what do you do with this phrase, which we've said is a contrast? You've got to see those two together. Yeah. So what does the image of a servant mean? Well, it doesn't really mean anything, does it?
We don't have an alternative Genesis account with a divine servant.
Yeah, so again, I think you're left scratching your head with that. And then you go back to the fact that morphe, this word form, means outward appearance. So it doesn't mean the image of God in the sense of Genesis is using it, as in, you are my representatives on it, but here is humanity as God's image, Yahweh's image. Again, it seems like we're missing something. Despite that, the allusions to the temptations in Genesis 3, I think that's good. They're probably genuine allusions there. There's a swirling around of scriptural thought right from Genesis 2 and 3 that kind of building forward to Christ, to Jesus. And there's something there that Jesus doesn't do, which humanity generally all do. Like, they take the opportunities in front of them. But I feel like there's still a missing piece, or maybe a few missing pieces.
Yes, it does feel like we've ticked a few more boxes with interpretation number two. I think we're getting a bit closer. But how else could we approach this? Introduce the next way of thinking about this to us.
Okay, so the next one is to sort of think about this as if it's talking about status. So we've thought about, the first one was, well, it's just referring to Jesus, his divinity, the fact that he is a very nature God. We've put a question mark over that. And then the next one is, well, it's referring to the fact that he's a human. And I mean, it is talking about him being a human, but that doesn't seem that phrase is trying to convey that. So we've put a question mark over that. So the other idea is that this is talking about status and the roles that come with status. And this probably is worked backwards a little bit, because we've got something very good that's going for it for this interpretation, because we've already had the form of a servant. So it's explicitly about a role performed by the lowest status individual. And Jesus deliberately takes this on. So we've absolutely got this word, servant or slave, that Jesus is choosing to take on. He's choosing a status and a role, which is surprising for someone who the onlookers see he is in the form of God, and yet he chooses this status. It reminds me, and it reminds many other interpreters as well, of John chapter 13. So John 13 is John's account of the upper room, the night before Jesus was crucified. And it's only John that records Jesus washing the disciples' feet. He lays aside his garment, his outer garment, puts a towel around him, and then goes to wash the disciples' feet.
It's a very powerful section, because Jesus had been a teacher, a healer. He was the leader and director of the 12. And in this example, gives up the power, the authority that he could have exerted. And it's challenging for the disciples. Simon Peter is clearly uncomfortable and thinks that this is a wrong move on Jesus' part.
And in John 13, he says, after he'd done this, verse 12, when he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments, resumed his place, he says, do you understand what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I have given you an example. So we're absolutely in the perfect moment of Jesus giving an example. And that's what Philippians 2 is all about. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And it's at the moment just before he dies, he's on that journey to the cross. And it symbolizes him laying down his life, laying aside his outer garment and washing, sanctifying his disciples. And that's exactly what Philippians 2 is about, actually, which we haven't really thought about yet, have we? But it goes on to say he humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So that's the kind of the flow of the Philippians 2 passage, building up to that moment, washing of the disciples' feet in John 13, seems to have a lot of parallels, actually, between these two passages.
The other thing, just as you were talking about that, my mind went to other places where Jesus talks about being a servant. It's not only the John 13. I think that's the prime example of Jesus demonstrating that in this physical act and outworking of that. But that has been part of his teaching in a number of different places in other areas as well. I was thinking of Mark chapter 10. Towards the end of that chapter, Jesus says in verse 42, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. And verse 43, but it shall not be so among you. He's saying that this isn't the way it's going to work. Yeah. Instead, if you want to be great, you need to be a servant. If you want to be first, you're going to have to serve all the other ones. And then famously in verse 45, he says, even the Son of Man, speaking of himself, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. So this idea of Jesus willingly, and also the disciples finding it difficult to understand and sort of disagreeing with this, but Jesus willingly becoming a servant, doing acts of service, and encouraging those who would follow him to be servants is something we see in a lot of different places. Typified, I think, as you say, in sort of the high point of this is John chapter 3. If we're bringing this idea into our interpretation and having this kind of in the back of our minds as we're reading Philippians chapter 2, Jesus being in the form of God, but choosing to act this way, to take on this role of servant, and we're thinking about, as you said, this idea of status and authority of God, to give up that status, as it were, and to be willing to be a servant, might be quite helpful as we think about how to interpret this section of Philippians chapter 2.
Yeah, that's right. And this phrase, being in the form of God, then becomes something about the status of an authority of God. A little bit like, for example, when Jesus was baptized, he's declared the Son of God. So Matthew chapter 3, for example, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. So there's a real declaration of status there. You know, he is the Son of God. And then what happens is in chapter 4 is the temptation narrative of Jesus. Yeah. If you are the Son of God, do this. Use the power for yourself. And culminating into the temptation to take all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And obviously he refuses those temptations in front of him, even though he has that status of being the Son of God. So I think there's something powerful going on there, actually. There's these links between Philippians 2 and the Genesis temptation account of Eve and Adam, the man and the woman, where they fail, and then the perhaps even more powerful links with Jesus and his temptation and his declaration of being the Son of God and how that brought temptation to him, and yet he succeeded in that, and he is that ultimate example.
Okay, so that ultimate example then helps us, I think, as we think about this context in Philippians. Paul is, if he is trying to get the believers to follow the example of Jesus, what does that look like? Well, it means not being proud or ambitious, but instead be willing to take on this role of servant and to serve one another. So I think that, yeah, definitely helps us as we think about what Paul is doing here and the response that he is expecting as we read through this section.
Now, if we sort of stopped here, we've been talking for a bit, and if we just stopped here, I think we've got enough to understand this passage and understand the focus of it. I feel like we've brought out problems with that really sort of common interpretation, as if this is about metaphysics of a pre-existing son or the pre-existing logos or whatever you understand the second person of the Trinity to be, becoming human. There's quite a few problems with that, I think. And actually, that's so far removed from the real practical issues that this passage is talking about and addressing, which we've seen in those echoes to the temptation narratives. I feel like those things are strong enough to show that enough. But there are still a couple of problems. So if you want to hang on, we'll maybe just dot a few I's and cross a few T's and just make it even more satisfactory, because we've still got this problem that morphe, this Greek word, morphe, it doesn't mean status. It doesn't mean essence or nature, but it doesn't mean status either. It means outward appearance. And we've still got that verse at the end, in translated by the ESV, end of verse 7, being born, as if the choosing to be born was a humble decision. So I think there's two things we need to just iron out. I'm going to be drawing on Andrew Perriman's book, which I've already quoted a little bit. So his book, In the Form of a God, it's quite recent. So I suppose it's up for scholarly discussion. It'll get looked at and discussed and responded to and so on. That's great. That's what happens. But he's quite systematically has gone through the backgrounds to the word morphe and seen the various conclusions that we've talked about a little bit. And the clue's in the title. So in the form of a God, he would say, actually, that's a very valid translation of that. And that we're not talking about the God of Israel at all. We're talking about the outward appearance of Jesus in the eyes of a pagan Gentile. So Philippi, being in Macedonia, when Paul is writing this letter, depending on where you put it, there's been several decades of preaching in the Greek world around people who have very different conceptions of the world and conceptions of God and gods than the Jewish world does. So when people hear the stories of Jesus in that context, what do they see him as? What outward appearance does he have to them? What public reputation does he have? What form do they assume he was in? And actually, we've got a real example of this in the Acts. We've got a couple of examples, actually. So in Acts chapter 14, we have Paul and Barnabas. They come to Lystra, and they do this miracle to a chap that never walked, and he gets up and starts walking. And they say in verse 11, when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in Lycaonian, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. So there you go. When the wonder worker comes, like Jesus was, and does these things, what's their instant reaction? It is, well, they are gods. They are in the form of a god, each one of them. In fact, we'll give them names. They're an appearance of one of these gods.
Yeah, so that outward appearance, they're able to interpret and judge that from looking at what they see and say, ah, okay, yeah, I recognize this pattern. I recognize this situation here. This must be the work of a god.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And you get something very similar to Paul later on when he's been shipwrecked in Acts chapter 28. And you remember when he's on Malta and he puts his hand, puts wood on the fire and a snake comes out to bite him. And they think that he's a murderer because of that. Justice has not allowed him to live. But he, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. So two quite clear examples of this. A pagan worldview, seeing miraculous things, hearing these stories about Jesus, what would they see him as? They would see him as a god. That would be their first idea or first conclusion. And this passage then becomes like a journey of people's perception and understanding of what Jesus was based on what he appeared. He was, when we first heard about him, there he was in the form of a god, one of these semi-divine heroes and things like that.
So yes, if your background, if you're steeped in the culture and the worship of Roman and Greek gods, then yes, that's your sort of knee-jerk reaction. Think, oh, okay, yes, it must be similar to the stories I know already. And so this interpretation, this suggestion is that we should read then Philippians chapter 2, this section, think, okay, Jesus being in the form of a god, and so that's calling out to those who have this Gentile pagan sort of perception that the people in Philippi may well have had.
And then the thing is that he doesn't live up to those expectations, does he? I mean, possibly a little bit like what Paul and Barnabas experienced, because later on the Jews get the crowd to turn on them and stone them. And then they realize when they're dead and they're being stoned, or not dead, but they assume that they're dead, they realize that they're just in the likeness of men. They're just ordinary people. That we made a mistake. They weren't gods after all. And so actually, this is something very similar to that happens to Jesus and the stories of Jesus. So they have all these expectations of, you know, Heracles or other semi-divine figures grasping at opportunities they have to take power and control. You know, all the feats of Hercules to do these things so that he can get the power and become divine figure and so on. Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar, they grasp opportunities in front of them, obviously real people, to become dictator and then emperor, and they become immortalized as gods. So it's this kind of, in this world where people and semi-divine figures and gods have the opportunities in front of them, they grasp them and they take that power. So Jesus, the stories of him, as people would expect, oh, he's a powerful wonder worker, he's saying words of wisdom, he's going to take the chance to seize power, except he doesn't. He doesn't at all. He chooses the role of a servant. He has the outward appearance of a servant because of the things that he chooses to do, the things that he says. And all the pagans realize that he's just an ordinary man. He's in the likeness of men, just an ordinary man like everyone else, even to the point of dying on the cross, the slave's death. That's the twist in this passage. But of course, it's not really mentioned in this passage, the resurrection of Jesus, but it's the resurrection which kickstarts Christianity. Of course, without it, it wouldn't have ever started, would it? And it's that and the fact that God has highly exalted him, that's the powerful thing that should impact your behavior and change you and be this practical example. God has made the person Lord and ruler. He's highly exalted this person, and it's someone who was willing to spurn all the opportunities for gaining an advantage himself and instead become a slave to help others. That's the person that God has made Lord and Christ and raised to this highly exalted position. That's the example, you know, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about an example, and you can see how this interpretation, I think, kind of completes the circle and shows you how you get in a context of preaching to Gentiles and pagans, how they would understand this and understand this as a powerful example for them.
That is really helpful. It's very powerful. That sort of opens it up and clarifies that quite a bit. Though I've still got a question, though. That helps us with the morphe word, the form of section. What about, with this understanding, the verse 7 part where it talks about being born in the likeness of men? How does that part work with this sort of fourth way of understanding?
Yeah, that was the one sort of last loose end really to tie up. And it's, again, you can look at different translations. So that the word that the ESV has decided to translate, being born, it doesn't necessarily have within its meaning specifically being born. It basically just means becoming, and it can mean that if the context dictates it. So it can mean being born. If you become something, being born is one way of becoming something, isn't it? Sure. But it isn't the only way of translating it. And as we've seen, I think the context around it actually makes it really difficult to translate it like that. So the NRSV updated edition is a cutting edge of translation.
Oh yeah.
It's been updated recently. I'll just read you what that says. So it talks about Jesus, he emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, assuming human likeness, and being found in appearance as a human, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. So there's that assuming human likeness, or becoming human likeness. That's the idea. So again, think about this from the perspective of onlookers. So people saw Jesus in the form of a god, and they thought that he should grasp at equality with God, but he didn't. He emptied himself. He took upon him the form, the outward appearance of a slave, and he therefore assumed ordinary human likeness. It became apparent to us that he was just like everyone else. You know, it became clear to us that he was a human being, not a god, and he humbled himself to the death on the cross. So that I think we've said all through this, This is a contentious passage. This is difficult. And we're hopping around different translations and showing, if there's one thing to draw from this, even if you don't agree with the different things that we've put forward, the thing that we've all got to agree on is that there are lots of different ways that people have come to an understanding of this. And therefore, it's not a passage that you can say, oh, it's definitely teaching incarnation, or it's definitely teaching the divine second person of the Trinity, or it's definitely teaching those things. It absolutely isn't definitely teaching those things at all. and here's a way, and I think it's a way that seems to tick all the boxes of understanding this in the context of the time and in the context of the letter.
Yeah, we spoke about the context of the letter at the beginning, and then we've brought in this idea of the context of the time and those coming with their perception of Jesus from a Greek-Roman god background. But as you say, yes, we've got to think carefully also about what Paul is doing here and what he's expecting as the response from those in Philippi. And that last interpretation you've looked at, I think, helps us in that, because it's still talking about not the birth of Jesus, but instead his willingness to go to the cross, to be a servant, to deny himself and to put others ahead of himself, which is what Paul is asking of the Philippians, what he is trying to get as a response from them. And it's what he's going to continue to do in this letter as well. He gives the examples of Timothy later on. Here's another person who's proven worth. He's suffered and is concerned for your welfare. Epaphroditus, there's another fellow work, another person.
Yep.
He's been so distressed that he was ill. And so our understanding of the beginning of this chapter, as we've looked at, those last two definitely help us get much, much closer
definitely.
To that kind of driving point that Paul's trying to get. It also demonstrates, I suppose, that this is something that you are able and should be encouraged to do.
So one final thing is the end of this passage, which we've not really talked about at all, but it's that very famous hymn, "At the Name of Jesus, Every Knee Shall Bow," which I'm sure you know. I'm not going to sing it right now. But so, "At the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." So there's a massive sort of exaltation there of God, actually. This is all to the glory of God the Father. And it's a quote, or definitely part of this is a quote from Isaiah 45. And actually, the context of that quote is really interesting, because if the interpretation that I've suggested is right, this is about pagans, Gentiles, completely non-Jewish people understanding who Jesus is and what he's done and the power of that. And that's exactly the quote, the context of Isaiah 45. So verse 22 says, "Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth. I am God, there is no other. By myself I have sworn, from my mouth has gone out in righteousness, a word that shall not return. To me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear allegiance." So and this whole chapter and context is of everyone, all the ends of the earth, far away, that will come and recognize the God of Israel as their God and worship him. And so this is how it happens. Jesus, who looked like he was just a semi-divine figure going around grasping equality, turns out he wasn't. And he was a human being like us who did an incredible, humble thing, even though he was the Son of God. And his example of going to the cross is the example that we should look to. And it calls us and draws all people to him. As John 12 says that, doesn't it? That the cross will be lifted up and draw all people to him to basically bow down and worship God the Father. So there we go. Perhaps that does the final icing on the cake.
Yeah, ending on that crescendo, that wonderful high note. Dan, thank you so much for walking us through the winding path that we have gone down to try and better understand this section of Paul's letter to the Philippians. So thank you to all of you who have joined us for this episode. Make sure you head to BibleFeed.org to have a look at the show notes for more information about some of the books and things that we have talked about in this episode. And until next time, thank you so much for spending some time with us.